I am one shear behind, and I want to kind of make up. So I'm going to ask Mitchell to somehow fit in an extra hour, so I'll be able to do an extra, not an extra shear, but a shear that will fit the schedule. So although today's shear was supposed to be Aguna, and I'm going to get an extra hour for that in, but today I'm going to talk about the Gullus of Yishmael, which was yesterday's topic, and I did not talk about that yesterday. Again, I apologize. I know that if some people came, especially for one, I am very, very sorry, but God willing, there will be the Aguna class to be announced. I want to talk a little bit about the concept of the four exiles and the exile of Galut Yishmael, which is often called the fifth exile, although it might be described as 4.1. And the concept of the idea of four galiots is very deeply enmeshed, not only in Tanakh, but also in Chazal, over and over and over again. According to the Medrash Rabbah, the idea of the four exiles is merumas in the very beginning of the Torah. The Torah says, Ha'aretz ha'isa sohu valvohu v'choshech al p'nei tahom. The world was, or the universe before it was created, the pre-creation state, was tayhu, was confused, or empty, and confused, and there was darkness on the face of the depths. The Medrash Rabbah says that tayhu, the emptiness, is the gullus of Babel, Babylonia, that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and made the world empty of Kedusha. Vayu, confusion, so emptiness is Babel. Confusion is Paras, Persia, which had the gezeira of genocide in the time of Haman. What does the Torah say? When Haman got the decree that the Jewish people would be wiped out, Ho'ir Shushan Nevocha, the city of Shushan was confused. So Bohu is a remez to Paras. Choshech, darkness, is a remez to the gullus of Greece, because Greece darkened the eyes of the Jewish people by taking them away from Torah and Avoda with all of the gezeros of Antiochus. And al p'nei tahom, on the face of the depth, is a remez to the gullus of Rome, which seems to go on and on forever and forever until the Mashiach comes, much, much longer than every other gullus. The gullus of Babel was 70 years. The Persian rule over the Jewish people was around 52 years, although historians make it a little longer. The Greek period, which includes the Hasmonean period, was less than 200 years. But the Galut of Edom, the Galut of Rome, still goes on and on. It's called Al Pnei Tahom. And therefore, the Medrash Rabbah says the concept that the Jewish people will undergo four Goliaths is built into the very fabric of the creation of the world. The way the Maral explains it in a very abstract way, the Maral says all growth and rejuvenation comes from a disintegration. When a seed is planted in the ground, the seed disintegrates, and then out of that disintegration comes a new life. So too, there is these four galiyot of persecution, out of which will come the light of the Mashiach and the redemption of the Jewish people. And that is the notion of the four galiyot. Now, in Tanakh in particular, the concept of the four galiyot appears very, very strongly in the various marot of Daniel, the book of Daniel. Daniel, as you know, made his reputation the same way Yosef made his reputation. In fact, you could very easily compare Yosef and Daniel. Daniel is from the Babylonian exile. Yosef made his career, so to speak, by interpreting the dreams of Paro and by understanding what Hashem was trying to tell Paro with the cows and with the sheaves of grain, etc. And Yosef had his own dreams. Well, the book of Daniel is very similar. Daniel was initially a young boy who was brought to Babylonia when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Israel, many, many years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And he was brought to be part of the royal courts, and the book of Daniel talks about many, many stories about how he, together with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, kept the mitzvot, even in that particular environment. But it mentions that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and the dream was of a great statue, and the head of the statue was gold, and the torso of the statue was silver, and the arms were copper. The arms and the upper legs were copper, and the lower legs and the feet were iron. And a great rock came, a great boulder came, and toppled the statue. And the statue was destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar woke up, and Nebuchadnezzar was very perturbed, and he didn't understand what the dream was. And Daniel interpreted the dream, and Daniel told him that this represents four kingdoms. You are the head of gold. So gold is Bavel, and the torso is Paras, silver, and copper is Greece, and the iron legs and feet are Rome. Now, by the way, the English expression, standing on clay feet, that indicates that somebody is weaker than he looks, is taken exactly from this passage because it mentions that the feet were partially iron and partially clay. And the rock that toppled over represents Hashem ultimately redeeming. Now, l'chora, this is not such a happy message for Nebuchadnezzar to hear, but Daniel gave him this message, and Daniel became, as it were, very esteemed, as Nebuchadnezzar understood the truth of this. So this is the idea of the four metals, the gold, the silver, the copper, the iron, and I'll discuss the significance of the clay and the iron that is intermingled. These are the four Goliaths, right, the four exiles. Similarly, in the book of Zechariah, you have the four horsemen, which is very, very prominent in many midrashim. Right? So clearly, the Arba Goliaths are mentioned in many places in Tanakh, and the Chazal do it as well. Now remember that the period of Chazal, by and large, by that I mean the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the early Midrashim, are all pre-Islamic. The Tanoim and Amoraim were not aware. I mean, there was no Islam yet. There was already Christianity and the like. And Chazal were very, very certain that the last Golos before the coming of the Mashiach is called the Golos of Edom, the Golos of Esav, based on the idea that the Roman Empire, which was ruling over most of the world, most of the known world, was in fact a descendant, or Esav was their ancestor, and they call that Golos Edom. Now, let me just stop for a moment. You still often see in many, many, even contemporary Sforim, that the Golos that we're in is still called the Golos of Edom. Now, you may wonder, why are we called the Golos of Edom? The Roman Empire is long gone. And why would be the Golos of Edom? There's no Edom anymore. Certainly the Italian government is not the Roman Empire, and they're not even related to the ancient Romans. So there are really a number of reasons why we still call this Golos Edom. And that is, it was Edom that destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash. So until that third Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, until what was destroyed is given back, we are still suffering from Golos Edom, even if the Edomites are gone. So this is the Golos that was precipitated by Edom. That is one reason. The second reason is the influence of both Western civilization and Christianity itself. That is, it is true, and I'll get to Golos in a while, that obviously Jews live in many, many countries, and there were many Jews who lived in Sephardic lands as well. But by and large, the history of the Jewish people has been linked in recent centuries with Christianity and Western civilization. And Rome, number one, is essentially the foundation of Western civilization, although Rome itself took it from Greece. But for example, the English alphabet is Rome. The legal systems of both the United States and of Europe are largely based on foundations of Roman law in different ways. Culturally, therefore, Western civilization is based on Rome, and since the history of most of the Jewish people, again, we'll talk about the other side of this, has been linked to Western civilization, we are still, as it were, suffering under the yoke of Edom. Moreover, it is also the fact that most of the historical destiny of the Jewish people has been linked with its confrontations and difficulties with Christianity. And Christianity, at a very early part of its history, although not at the very beginning, established its seat, at least Catholicism, which was the original Christianity established its seat in Rome. The Pope actually, the official title of the Pope is Bishop of Rome, which means actually, you know, you have the Bishop of Indianapolis and you have the Bishop of Rome. He's just a bishop among other bishops. So because of all of these reasons, we still call ourselves Galut Edom. Interestingly enough, before I get to the fifth Galut, which we need to talk about today, and those of us in Eretz Yisrael are especially attuned to what is called the fifth Galut, is let me just mention that the Medrash Rabbah, we talked a few days ago about the Dalet Tosfos of Yayin. There actually is a Medrash Rabbah that says that the four cups of wine are not only connected to the four Lashonot of Geula in Mitzrayim, but they are actually connected to the four Goliaths, as if to say, just as God redeemed us from Mitzrayim, God redeemed us and will redeem us from the four exiles. So one coast is connected to the redemption from the Golot of Bavel, which of course occurred when we rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash. And the second is the redemption from Persia, which occurred with Mordechai and Esther. And the third is the redemption of Yavan that occurred, from Yavan that occurred in the Hanukkah story, and the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash. And the fourth hasn't happened yet. But that fourth is the redemption from the Golos of Edom that will culminate in the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. Meaning the Medrash links the redemption of Mitzrayim with all of the future redemptions, because Mitzrayim is the Shoresh. In fact, it's fascinating, just to draw a correlation here. One Medrash links the four cups to the four exiles. Another Medrash links the four cups to the four evil decrees of Paro. And now, what are the four evil decrees of Paro? Decree number one is slavery. Decree number two is throwing the Mialdos, the midwife that was aborted, no pun intended, but that decree wasn't carried out, but that's when the Mialdos were told to kill the babies, Shifra and Puah, Yocheved and Miriam. Decree number three is when the Egyptians threw the babies into the water. And decree number four was when the Jewish people had to gather their own straw and not diminish their levainim, their bricks. And the Medrash says the Dalet Lashonos of Geula are connected the four Gezeros of Paro. So keep these two Midrashim side by side for a moment. The four cups of wine and the four Lashonos of Geula are connected the four decrees of Paro. Other Medrash says it is connected the four Galiyot of Bavel, Paras, Yavan, and Edom. Two Midrashim. The Chiddushei Arim wants to make a very interesting correlation. The Chiddushei Arim actually wants to say that in Mitzrayim are the seeds of every one of the four Goliaths. And in fact, he offers a remark that is very disheartening. He says, we should have been in Mitzrayim 400 years. Hashem took us out after 210 years because we were hitting the 50th level of impurity and we would have been irredeemable. We all know that. That's the meaning, we didn't have time to let our dough rise. But here is what the Chiddushei Arim says. Had we completed the 400 years, we would have completed the entire Galut cycle, and there wouldn't have been a need for any other Galut for the rest of our existence. It is only because the protocol was terminated early that we need to suffer the thousands of years that we suffer. The analogy would be chemotherapy. Rachmana Litzlan, if someone needs to take chemotherapy, sometimes the chemotherapy has to be discontinued before the cancer is gone, because the chemotherapy might kill the patient. But, Rachmana Litzlan, if it is truncated, even though it had to be truncated, that leaves the cancer in the body, which could then spiral in a bad way. This is exactly what the Chiddushei Arim says. we needed this process of 400 years as tikkun. But we couldn't go through that tikkun because we would have hit the 50th level. So the therapy had to be stopped. But because it stopped, we now need thousands of years. So if you understand that Mitzrayim is the shorish of all of the Galiyot, and it was intended to take the place of all the Galiyot, the Chnisharim wants to correlate the four Gezeros of Parah with the four Galiyot. Let's see how this is so. Gezerah number one of Parah was simply servitude and slavery. That corresponds to Babel, because if you think about it, it was Babel that destroyed, on the most simple level, the sovereignty of the Jewish nation. See, Persia and Greece did not do that, because we actually, until the Hasmoneans, until the Hasmonean, we were already Serbs, we didn't have independence. Meaning Babel took away our independence, and then Persia just conquered Babel, and Yavan conquered Persia. So Babel corresponds to the Avdus. So the characteristic of Babel is taking away our freedom and our sovereignty. Now the second Gezerah was a potential genocide, that the Mialdos were ordered to murder babies. But that didn't happen. That didn't happen. That corresponds exactly to the Gullus of Persia. What was the singular event in the Persian Gullus? The Gezerah of Haman, Lahashmid, the Laharog, which didn't happen. So that corresponds to the second Gezerah of Paro, which didn't happen, that the Mialdos would kill the Jewish babies. Now, the third Gezerah is a bit more subtle and a bit more difficult to connect to Greece, and that is where they threw the babies into the water. And that did happen to some degree, right? There were babies that were killed. How does that correspond with Greece? So here, the Chvisherim offers more of a homiletical thought. He says that the conflict that we had with Greece, now it's very interesting, people don't always understand this. From a certain perspective, although Antiochus was probably clinically crazy, but from a certain perspective, one could look at Antiochus, not from a Jewish perspective, but from a secular perspective, as a very progressive person. Antiochus was not a Hitler anti-Semite. Antiochus had an agenda of cultural assimilation and Hellenism. And he was perfectly willing to give Jews full political and social rights as long as they would abandon those qualities that made them distinctively Jewish. He was an advocate of a melting pot, albeit in a very coercive way, meaning you either join or I'll kill you. But it was not the Haman. Haman didn't care. Haman was Hitler. Haman did not care if you were religious or not religious. Haman wanted every biological Jew to be destroyed. Antiochus was totally a war against Jewish distinctiveness and the like. And as a result, many, many Jews went along with Antiochus' agenda even without coercion. They became Hellenists, they became assimilated, they became supporters of foreign ideologies and philosophies. So the Chiddush Yerim says, wisdom, not just Torah, wisdom can often be described as water. Even Greek wisdom, the deep philosophy and science and art, can be described as water. Water can give you life. But if you put your head in the water, it will drown you and kill you. So essentially, in a metaphorical way, sticking the babies in the water corresponds to exposing them to Greek culture, but doing it in such a way that it destroys their attachment to God. Right? So as a result, therefore, the third Gezerah of Pyro corresponds to Golas Yavan. But then we get to the fourth Gezerah. The fourth Gezerah seems to be nothing to do with that. That's what? Getting out and gathering straw. How does that correspond to Edom? So here, the thought is a very, very profound thought. He says, what's so bad about gathering straw? A few points. When you were given your straw and you had to make your quota of bricks, essentially, your productivity did not have to be at the expense of somebody else. Meaning, I have my straw, you have your straw, so I can make as many bricks as I can, and you can make as many bricks as you can. And your gain is not my loss. We're working independently. But when we have to compete and look around for the straw, so to speak, we now introduce the idea of competition, rivalry. And on one level, that is a remez to the gullus of Edom, which is filled with sinat chinam, polarization, rivalry, negativity, and the like. Moreover, psychologically, this phenomenon is referred to what is called pizur hanefesh. Pizur hanefesh is a scatter-mindedness in which we are buffeted with so many stimuli that we are unable to focus, unable to concentrate. You know, we talk about the internet as giving us an information explosion. And that's very, very true, and that's a very apt point. At some point, a person becomes overwhelmed with facts, with information, some of which, a large part of which, is not even true. But even the true information that's out there, I think there's a statistic that the world's knowledge, actually at this point, doubles every 10 years or so in amazing ways. But that has a very serious cost. We're so used to going from experience to experience, website to website, channel surfing to channel surfing. 500 channels and nothing to watch is the common complaint of those that have television or whatever it would be. And this prevents a person from focusing, from prioritizing, from determining what is important in life. And therefore, that is a new dimension of galus, in which the pizur, the scattering to find straw, is exactly the state of the disembodied fractionated, so to speak, state of mind by which we live in the world. We just don't have the ability to focus, to think, to take time to ask ourselves, what is our life about? Because we are so caught in the here and now. So therefore, Bavel represents loss of sovereignty. Persia represents genocide. Yavan represents cultural assimilation. And Edom represents inability to concentrate because one is torn in so many directions that one cannot focus. I remember years ago in Washington, I just saw an advertisement in a supermarket. It's kind of a gourmet supermarket in Bethesda, that they offer 300 types of mustard. So I was thinking to myself, putting aside the kashrus issues, I was thinking to myself, let's say, you know, while a husband is going to the store and wife says, pick up some mustard, you know, when you get there. What are you going to do? You walk in, 300 types of mustard. You know, sometimes it's easier, you know, the old, the old joke about a woman in old, in the old Soviet Union. She went into a meat store and she said, do you have steak? No. Do you have roast beef? No. Do you have hamburger? No. Have hot dogs? No. So one butcher says to the other butcher, he says, this woman is really such a nudge. But the other person said, but what a memory she has. You know, so sometimes there are certain virtues in not having the tyranny of choice. And the galut of pizur is not necessarily a galut of persecution, although there is persecution as well. It is the galut of being over, that's the correlation to the straw, being overwhelmed with frenetic activity, going from one place to the other place. And that truly describes the problem that we face in modern society. This is the great gift of Shabbat, the great gift of Yom Tov, in which essentially the world stops. The world does stop, so we focus inward on what makes us real, what makes us Jewish, what makes us human, what makes us connected to Hashem. Right? So this is kind of Bekitzur, the four exiles. Now, the emesis, the Eben Ezra already in the book of Daniel raised a fundamental problem that he had with Chazal. The Eben Ezra, of course, lived in the 11th century, and of course he lived at the height of the Islamic empires. He lived in those countries that were dominated by Islam, and he said, How can Chazal talk about the four exiles? What about the Arab countries who are descended from Yishmael, B'nai Yishmael? There are Malchus that ruled over so much of the world in those days. How could they not be counted? So because of this, the Ibn Ezra, who really didn't mind arguing with Chazal, the Ibn Ezra says, well, maybe we'll count the four Galiot differently. Galut number one is Bavel. Galut number two is Paras, Persia. Okay. Galut number three we'll call Yavan, Greece, and Rome, because after all, the Greco-Roman culture was kind of a common culture. And Galut number four is going to be Ishmael. Right? That's what the Ibn Ezra says. But suffice it to say that Chazal didn't count it that way. We always count Galut Edom as the last Galut. And yet, the Ibn Ezra's question still exists. Even if the Islamic Empire as a territorial entity is not necessarily that significant, although Ramaisa is pretty big even now, but still there is no question that the B'nai Yishmael exert on the world today a tremendous amount of domination in terms of psychological fear, in terms of terrorism, in terms of oil, and the like. So the emesis, if you go all the way back to Rav Chaim Vital was the great Talmud of the Arizal. He lived in the time of the Ari and Rav Yosef Karo in Sfat. That's where the Mekubalim were centered. This is in the 16th century. This is in the 1500s. And by the way, when we talk about the Ari's Kabbalistic system, the system almost in its entirety only comes to us through Rav Chaim Vital. The Ari himself wrote very, very little. And the entire system of what's called Lurianic Kabbalah is essentially via Rav Chaim Vital. But Rav Chaim Vital, in addition to writing what the Ari taught, Rav Chaim Vital wrote his own Sifrei Kabbalah. And Rav Chaim Vital has a Perish on Tehillim. And he writes that in spite of the fact that Chazal talked about the four Galiot, there will be a fifth Galut before Mashiach. He wrote this in the 1500s. Wow. And he said, this will be the Galut of Yishmael. And the Galut of Yishmael will be the worst and most difficult of all of the Galiot, because B'nai Yishmael will have no rachamim. They will have no compassion. They will not value life, neither their own life, nor the lives of others. And Rav Chaim Vital writes, based on an early medrash, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Actually, it's not an early medrash, but it's a medrash that may have been written after Islam. Where Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, and it's interesting, this was a medrash, obviously, but until 9/11, September 11th, 2001, many people didn't notice the medrash. After 2001, this was a rediscovered medrash that actually says, Yishmael and Yisrael are the only nations of the world that have God's name in their national identity. Yisrael, which was the name that Yaakov Avinu got when he defeated the angel of God. So Yisrael means he shall triumph with God. Kisarisa, es Elokim. And Yishmael, God listens. And therefore, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says, there is a divine koach in Yishmael that will be very, very difficult for Yisrael to defeat. And this is called the Galut of Yishmael. Now Rav Chaim Vital then proceeds to make two further points. Point number one is, and this is really a problem, that Yishmael and Islam are not identical. For example, Iran, which is certainly a major, major source of trouble and sorrows, is not an Arab country. It is an Islamic country, but it's not Arab. So you can be an Arab, you can be descended from Yishmael and be a Christian. So there are Arabs, there are B'nai Yishmael, who are not Islam, although that's a minority. And then conversely, you can be a Muslim and not B'nai Yishmael. So why do we call this the Galut of Yishmael? So Rav Chaim Vital actually brings a striking point, which he doesn't explain, so we don't know the full reason. He says B'acharit hayomim, the koach of paras, which represents the genocidal urge, going all the way back to Haman, the koach of paras will resurrect itself and be mitchaber to the koach of Yishmael. So he actually says, Yishmael and paras will have a hischabrut, and because Yishmael has this spiritual power, that will give paras the ability to do, the potential ability to do, what paras by itself was not able to do the first time. Now this is Reb Chaim Vital. This is quite an amazing statement, because this statement goes back to the 1500s and the like. So this is in our Svarim, and our Svarim talk about this Golut of Yishmael, and then he makes another point that is very fascinating, and he says, in Doniel, there's only four Goliot. There's the gold, there's the silver, there's the copper, and there is the iron. He says, no. Remember that the iron feet, some of the toes are iron, and some of the toes are chomer. Chomer is clay. But chomer could also be read as chamor, donkey. And Yishmael is referred to am hadomeh lechamor, a nation that is treated as a donkey. And therefore, in point of fact, there's a remez that at the tip, at the tail end, so to speak, of the galut of iron, which is Edom, there will be the clay of Yishmael, in which Yishmael will, in addition to connecting to Paras, Yishmael will also control the destiny of Edom through oil and economic activity and terrorism against the Edomite countries and the like. So it's an amazing thing. Again, I don't want to be in the business, as so many people do, of offering prognostications about the future. It's not, we're not Nevi'im, and as the Rambam says, to try to give detailed blueprints of the future, only foolish people will do. But at least the overall concept that there will be a difficult time in world history in which the Jewish people, and really the Edomite countries as well, in other words, the Western civilization, will be subjected to the persecutions of Yishmael, was seen already by the great Mekubalim, and indeed in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, a Medrash, it actually makes that point. Now, there are four short observations I want to make, though, about the Golot Yishmael, and then I want to take it as to what do we do practically about all of this. Number one is the point that Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer makes, that because Yishmael has a certain spiritual power, they cannot be defeated. This is an extraordinarily dangerous galut, because it cannot be defeated solely by military or political means. Now, if you think about this, here is the problem. Let's go back to the decades after World War II, right? World War II, the end of World War II initiated an arms race primarily between the United States and the former Soviet Union. Now, each one's building up their nuclear arsenal. Now, the theory, what kept the world relatively safe, although there were plenty of wars, particularly in Israel, but you know, there were no world wars, so to speak, is a philosophy that goes by the aptly named acronym MAD. Now, MAD is Mutual Assured Destruction, meaning what kept the world somewhat safe, although it didn't totally work, was that we knew the Soviet Union would never send an atom bomb against the United States, because they knew that we would send an atom bomb in return, and since they don't want to be destroyed, they're not going to try to destroy us. The fear of being destroyed acted as a deterrent. Mutual assured destruction meant nobody was going to do something. Baruch Hashem, Donald Trump wasn't president then, who knows, Dr. Strangelove or whatever it would be. Now, that type of logic only works if you value your life, you want to live. Even the Nazis, who represent the epitome of ultimate evil, a lot of them committed suicide with cyanide pills, but ultimately they were cowards. I mean, towards the end of the war, a lot of the Nazis were perfectly willing to make some type of deal to save their lives. They valued their lives. They didn't value anybody else's lives. But they were cowards. But when you have an enemy that on some level doesn't care if it lives or dies, when you have an enemy that is inculcated with a morality, or if you call it a morality, that dying for this type of cause gets them into a paradise, then the conventional deterrence, better not do this or we will do something, it simply does not work at all. The mutually assured destruction. So if, God forbid, you have this type of culture getting possession of a nuclear bomb, this is what your point was earlier, mad doesn't work anymore. No, go ahead and bomb us out of existence. Then, all the things that are supposed to happen in a good way are going to happen. So the enemy is very, very dangerous here. This is an enemy that does not respond necessarily to political or military force. We have to do our ishtadlus. You know, I live in Malodafna, right? Some of you might certainly live near there, if not in the neighborhood. And in the, Shimon HaTzadik, Rekevet HaKala, there's been a number of, we're right at the boundary of East Jerusalem. And, occasionally there are shootings there. Occasionally there are people who turn their cars into passengers or even police or military. And as a result, they beef up security. But what do you do? Are you going to stop every car? Are you going to take away driver's licenses of ours? Meaning the type of random, almost disorganized, spontaneous terrorist activities that just come from hatred, that just come from animosity, in which people don't consider their very lives worth anything. What are you going to stop? You can't really stop. So what Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer teaches us is that the galut of Yishmael in particular, Yishmael has spiritual merit. The spiritual merit of Brit Milah. In fact, there's even a medrash, it's a very interesting discussion, in which Yishmael tells Yitzchak, you had your Brit Milah when you were 8 days old. You didn't make a voluntary decision. And it doesn't hurt so much for a little kid. But I had my Brit at 13. I made a decision. I was Moser Nefesh for Brit Milah. So the medrash says, Yishmael has a sechus of Brit Milah. Yishmael has a certain sechus of praying to God, believing in God. Yishmael has a certain sechus of tzniut. Now, this brings us into a concept that I will admit I don't understand, but it is a concept that is brought down in Sifrei Kabbalah. That is, the same way a physicist will talk about matter and antimatter, there is a concept of what you might call dark spiritual energy. And that is, that even a person who is intent on doing evil, even a person who is intent on wreaking havoc, even a person that is engaged in immoral decision making, can have a certain spiritual negative energy that they get because of their connection to God through prayer and the like. You can call it dark spiritual energy. The Mishabalim might call it the Sitra Achra coming from the other side. But as a result, therefore, the bottom line is that Yishmael will ultimately be defeated only by spiritual means and not by physical. Because a philosophy that does not value life, their own lives, cannot be deterred. Again, all of you know the famous or infamous or controversial a statement of Golda Meir, and I'm not going to endorse or contest it at this point, but she made the point that we care more about the lives of the other side than not only the other side caring about our lives, but the other side caring about their lives, as it were. And this is the first lesson. The first lesson basically is Yishmael can be defeated by spiritual means. It has Hashem's name. It has dark spiritual energy. And conventional military and political means are not effective against this type of enemy. The second lesson that we have to ponder in this galus is that, in a way, as is always the case, there are hidden blessings. There are, as it were, linings, silver linings to the darkest clouds. And that is, what Hashem is teaching us in all of this is that nowhere in the world is safe. Meaning, people would always say, people say even today, I don't want to move to Israel, I can't make Aliyah because it's too dangerous to live here. I want to raise my children in a safe place. A safe place, like Paris, for example. Like London, like New York City, of course, which had 9/11. In a way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is creating a phenomenon, or is enabling, I don't want to say, at least allowing a phenomenon to happen, in which there is no place that is safe. There is no place. You can run, but you can't hide. And in many ways, this is precisely a message to bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. Bring us back to where we're in God's country. Because if it's dangerous to live everywhere, then I might as well be here. If God forbid, a person's going to die, then let it be here. Because it's not the idea, the cheshbon, that somehow it's going to be safer somewhere else, is just demonstrably false. And of course, even in a simple level, I get constant amusements, all the perplexity, when I'm out at 11:30 at night and I see 5-year-old kids and my neighbor walking the street. I'm wondering, why are they up at 11:30 at night? But how many American cities can a child walk around late at night?
During
the day, yeah. Eretz Yisrael, the truth of the matter is, even statistically, you cannot really make a case that it is more dangerous to live here. But be it as it may, one of the lessons of the ubiquity of Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic terrorism, is the world is not safe, and therefore come home, be here. The third idea, again, which is connected, is the very hopelessness of the situation, that there's really nothing we can do about it, might engender depression and despair. But it reminds me of a story involving the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav was trapped in the Warsaw Ghetto for a while during World War II, so miraculously he managed to escape and came to Eretz Yisrael. And the Brisker Rav, Rav Elwell, Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, had what you might describe as a nervous temperament, but that was because of his Yiras Shemayim. He was always worried whether he did a mitzvah properly. He would say Shema a number of times. He would be worried about the matzah and the chametz and the kashrus. He was always, and this is the characteristic of briskers even today, that they're always worried. In fact, there's a famous story about the Beis Halevi, right? The first famous Soloveitchik, who was Korosh Hashiva with the Nitziv. And the Nitziv once said about the Beis Halevi, it was an affectionate joke, he says, the difference between the Beis Halevi and I is how we enjoy the Seder. I make a Seder and it's the most enjoyable day of the night of the year. Two nights of the year. The Beis Halevi is a nervous wreck. Do we eat enough matzah, or maybe we shouldn't eat matzah because maybe it's chametz? That's a real dilemma. Do I eat more matzah to be yaseh? Do I eat less matzah because maybe it's chametz? He says, Beis Halevi is a nervous wreck. He can't enjoy Pesach. He says, I can enjoy Pesach. So the Brisker Rav had that tradition. And the Brisker Rav was very, very, very nervous about mitzvahs. He's in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was. In fact, he lost his mishpacha there. He lost his rebbetzin there. And he seemed to be calm. He had equanimity. He learned. He taught. So somebody had the chutzpah. It's a big chutzpah. Ask him this. Somebody had the chutzpah. Rebbe, you're always so nervous. How can you be calm now? So he says, when I am nervous, when things are within the purview of my responsibility, and I can do something about it. Mitzvos are my job. When it's my job, I'm nervous. I make mistakes. I may not do it right. I am constantly worried. When it's up to me, I'm scared. But what if you're in a situation where there's really nothing you can do at all? Some people go crazy. Some people feel hopeless, and that's it. With me, it's the other way around, the Brisker Rav said. Precisely when I'm not able to do anything, I know Hashem is in charge. When Hashem is in charge, I can let go. Now, the Brisker Rav did not mean, in a Pollyannish sense, everything will turn out nice. Obviously it didn't. 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. The Biskarov lost both his Rebbetzin and his child in the Holocaust. He was not suggesting everything is going to have a happy ending. Sadly, that is not the way life always is. But he was confident in God's love. He was confident that there is reason and purpose in all the turbulence that happens in the world. And that if things happen, it is not because Hashem has abandoned us and doesn't care, but it's something that we have to rise to and get strength to deal with. And he will give us the strength to move forward. So the third lesson here is that precisely in our inability to improve the situation appreciably is a sign that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take over. Now, the fourth point I wanted to make is this. You know, I work for Or Sameach. Or Sameach is a kiruv. It works with kiruv rechokin. We try to bring Jews closer to Torah in different ways. Although I do have to say, a large percentage of Or Sameach are actually kids who are religious from birth, but they need to be inspired in various ways. But here I'm going to say something that may sound very, very wrong. That is, that in some ways, we are jealous of the Kirov organization that is known as ISIS, or ISIL, as Obama likes to call it. And what do I mean with this? ISIS is a vicious, evil organization that is so degenerate that even fellow terrorists, you know, condemn them in various ways. But then one of the very bizarre things that you see is, you know, these 16-year-old girls from Pennsylvania trying to board a plane to go to Syria to join ISIS, you know, probably the week after they had an ice cream social or went ice skating in Wisconsin. And what is going on here? How do you take a normal American kid raised with normal parents, going to normal schools, normal culture, who wants to go to ISIS? Like, where does that even come? It is insane. It would be funny if it wouldn't be tragic. And the answer is, there is also something very profound here in this very dysfunctional response. That is, the world is reaching a level where secularism and decadence and materialism has turned into a dead end. There is a desperate search for meaning and purpose, to be connected to a cause that goes beyond yourself. That you can't, you know, teenagers are coming to the Hakara, that you can't just live to make more money, more pleasure. So people are scurrying around looking for meaning, looking for purpose, looking for something greater than themselves to identify. So they turn to these crazy, toxic responses. Like a starving person might, you know, take in salt water or poison if they're thirsty enough. But it emanates from a genuine desire for something greater than the selfishness that has characterized modern society, really for so many centuries at this point. So in many ways, just like Rabbi Akiva, when Rabbi Akiva saw the destroyed temple, and if you recall, this was many years after the Chorban already, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, when Rabbi Akiva saw the destroyed temple and the Chachamim were crying because they saw a fox leave the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and Rabbi Akiva was laughing, and they asked Rabbi Akiva, why are you laughing? And he said, why are you crying? Well, we're crying because we see the holiest place in the world is being desecrated by rodents and animals. And Rabbi Akiva said, in that very destruction, I see the signs of Hashem's promise. There's going to be a redemption. So in many ways, in the very movements that are so destructive, we see on some level, certainly the attraction of people in the West to these movements, that there's some desire to be connected to something greater. And therefore, within the Chorban, you can see hope. So these are just some points to think about in a preliminary way. Now, let me just mention that the Vilna Gaon writes that although Chazal talk about 70 nations that attack the Jewish people. We are like a sheep among 70 nations. The Vilna Gaon says, all of the nations are yonek. They get their spiritual sustenance from either Esav or Yishmael. 35 are Esav, 35 are Yishmael. Now, the Vilna Gaon certainly does not mean 35 are descended from Yishmael and 35 are descended from Esav. He is referring to spiritual kochos. I would like to suggest that what Esav and Yishmael represent, and that's the last galus, the combination of Esav and Yishmael, are two evils that challenge us, but in opposite directions. Esav represents the dead end of rejection of God, of hedonism, of materialism, of secularism, that kind of started in the age of the Enlightenment. A mindless materialism in which one's goal in life is self-aggrandizement and pleasure-seeking. That is why when Yaakov wants to buy the spiritual birthright from Esav, so what does Esav say? Esav says, I don't care, no big deal. Hine anochi holech lamus. Balama zali b'chova. Why do I need the birthright? Behold, I'm going to die. And the Mephoshim say, it doesn't just mean I'm so hungry I'm going to die, but it means, after I die, there is no eternity, there is no soul, there is no transcendent God. I live for the here and now. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. And therefore, Esav represents the rejection of God in life, making God irrelevant. And although you might ask, well, that's kind of a contradiction to identifying Esav with Christianity. But the truth of the matter is, in most Christian countries, maybe all, Christianity is essentially irrelevant. Either people don't keep it, don't believe it, or it's simply something that's ritualistic that has no impact on life. Religion as irrelevancy. The main thing in life is pleasure seeking, self-aggrandizement, egotism. That is Esav. Yishmael represents a different danger. The utilization of God and religion as tools of fanaticism and evil and destruction. So in a way, this is exactly the Jew between the rock and the hard place. On one hand, we face the decadism and secularism and agnosticism, even if formally you have some religion, which is represented by Esav's attitude of Hine Anochi Olech Mamos V'Lama Zali B'Chora. So in one case, you're ignoring God or relegating God to an irrelevancy. In the other case, you are besmirching God by utilizing divinity for the perpetuation of evil and violence. And these are truly what the Vilna Gaon might mean when he suggests that the Umos HaOlam that try to attack us might utilize two different strategies. There is the strategy of assimilation, hedonism, and decadence that represents the Koach of Esav. And then there is the strategy of religious fanaticism and extremism that invokes God, constantly invokes God, but invokes God in an immoral and an evil and a destructive manner. This is the gullus of Edom, the gullus of Yishmael. And as Rav Chaim Vital says, there will be this hischabrus of these two forces, Biacharit Hayamim, with Persia coming in to add the genocidal aspect of it, as Rav Chaim Vital says, which kind of explains how we're being buffeted in so many different ways. Now, this would suggest, now let me go a little further with this, and that is, as I said the other day, the enemies that are outside of us are to some degree reflective of imperfections within our own character. And that suggests, if we are buffeted with an Esav and Yishmael mibachutz, there is an Esav and Yishmael that is struggling within us. The Esav within us seeks the life of leisure, the life of moral relativism, the life of ease, the life of comfort, the life of living for the moment. That's the Esav that is within us. The Ishmael within us comes into the guise of religious extremism. Now again, I want to be very, very careful. God forbid, in no possible way am I creating a moral equivalence between Islamic fundamentalism and Jews who are very, very strong and stark in their belief. But there is a shemitz, there is something in which there is a connection. That when there is sinas chinam, when there's a lack of avas Yisrael, when there is demonization, when there's an unwillingness to look at a fellow Jew and try to see their good, there is that aspect of using one's religiosity as a way of demeaning and shaming others, and that comes from a koach of Yishmael. Again, God forbid, there is no moral equivalence at all, but as I say, a little pagam in a Jewish soul can in the outside world get magnified into an awful thing. Just like when you start a bridge and it's, you know, 1 inch off, by the time you get it to the end, it may be 100 miles off or 1,000 miles off. So we have a similar idea. So this suggests that we do have these two nisyonos. In other words, on one hand, we fall into the Esav trap in which Yiddishkeit doesn't matter so much. You know, somebody once described a certain philosophy of Judaism, of people who are religious Jews, in which instead of perceiving 613 mitzvos, they perceive 613 problems that they have to navigate around. Meaning, there is an attitude, and again, Baruch Hashem, these are people who keep mitzvos. And I don't even say they, because I will say personally that I myself, you know, will be guilty of this sometimes. So I don't want to create barriers. I would then be doing the very thing that I'm criticizing a little bit. But we or I, whatever, we sometimes kind of look at mitzvot as obstacle courses that prevent us from doing what we really want to do. So we work on ways of circumventing. You know, a few months ago or last year, there was something called the Shabbos app, where somebody invented, actually it's a very interesting question in Lumbus, some way that you could do text messaging on Shabbos and the like, as if to say, oh yeah, yeah, how can I possibly not text on Shabbos? Right? So somebody wanted to invent a halachically appropriate way. It was not accepted by anybody, but there at least was a try. You know, who knows? Somebody, we need a Kindle on Shabbos, or whatever it would be, as if to say that Shabbos alone isn't good enough for me. I got to find a way to have technology even on Shabbos. So that's kind of the Esav idea. I don't want all of these burdens. I want to make it as easy as possible so I don't have to focus on it. But then there's the Ishmael in us that is always denigrating, always judging, always criticizing, always looking for mumin, blemishes, imperfections in others. Find how somebody, you know, has a little bit of apikorsis and they're treif and they're no good. That comes from the Ishmael of using ruchnius and using God and using divinity as a way of demeaning and disparaging. So the Esav and Ishmael is played within us. Now let me tell you another thought of Rav Chaim Vital. Rav Chaim Vital says, when Esav and Ishmael get together, the progeny that is produced is Amalek. Now obviously this is not a biological phenomenon, but Rav Chaim Vital says it in the following way. This is a little Kabbalistic, but hopefully it'll be Kabbalah light. He says, we find that Esav is called Shor, the mighty ox. Yishmael is called Chamor, the donkey. Take the panimiyat of those words. Panimiyat means the inner. So take the inner letters. The inner letters of Shor is Vav. Shor is only three letters, so Vav is six. The inner letters of Chamor is Memvav, 46. 46 and 6 is 52. 52 is the gematria of Kelev. And Chazal say Amalek is called a wild dog. So again, a biologist wouldn't understand this, but when you mate a shor and a chamor, you get a wild dog. And he says, the koach of Amalek is when you meld the Esav and Yishmael of the world. Now here, we can take this even further, and that is, although I've described Esav and Yishmael as opposite attitudes, in fact, on some level, they actually meld together. Because you see, when I focus my energies on disparaging the religiosity of the other, that actually gives me a little bit of a pass to be more lenient in not looking at what I need to do. So in effect, the Yishmael in me empowers the Esav in me. Because I spend my energy pointing out where you're wrong, instead of working on myself. Right? So, once again, as is always the case, of course, we have to work on chitzonius. And we have to be absolutely grateful every day for the military, for the chayolim, for the police. Because you should know that for every, God forbid, terrorist action that takes place, there are 20 to 30 that were stopped and nipped in the bud. You know, we don't even know the Chasdei Hashem, and we don't even know the great, great things that the army does for Am Yisrael. We have to be absolutely grateful. Makes no difference. Religious, secular, Hester, whatever it is. Hakaras HaTov. But at the same time, we have to realize that ultimate Nitzachon depends on the panemius of our spiritual lives. And political and military strategies against this type of enemy have a very, very limited effectiveness due to the fact that this is an enemy that is not machshev, its own life. Let me just end that in particular, during this period of Sfiras HaOmer, we actually are combating both forces. Because think of it this way. On one hand, Sfiras HaOmer is the count up to Shavuos. So we're ready to receive the Torah. That requires that we intensify our commitments, our frumkeit, our limud haTorah, our shmirat haMitzvot. That's what you do when you get ready for Kabbalah haTorah. That's combating the Esav that only lives for hedonism and self-gratification. On the other hand, we also know that during Sfira, this is the time when we commemorate the deaths of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. That's a later development, obviously. And the Gemara in Yevamos tells us that the students of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show proper respect, kavod, for each other. So that effectively says, I look at the other Jew and I try to see their goodness. I try to see their sacrifice. Again, this might apply particularly, as I say, to chayolim and the like, in which, as you know, and again, I'm not going to get into this, but as you know, there's a major, major debate in Eretz Yisrael, in the world, basically, about the drafting of yeshiva boys and the fact that, on one hand, this would take some people out of yeshiva. On the other hand, some say, well, shivoy hanetel, everyone should be equal. A debate, Gedolim have basically talked about the vital importance of Torah learning for Klal Yisrael. But here is the thing. There are debates, and these are important debates and difficult debates, but one, I think, has to still understand that on one hand, the primacy of Torah, and on the other hand, the tremendous gratitude that we have to have to those who physically put their lives on the line as well. And I would suggest, perhaps, it's not really revolutionary, but I think in the way in society it turns out to be a revolutionary thought, but it's a very simple thought. And that is, Shlomo HaMelech says in Mishlei, Kamayim apanim alpanim kein leif adam liadam. As water reflects the face that you show it, so too is the heart of one person to another. And the Vilna Gaon explains, when I look into water, if I smile at the water, I see a smiling face. If I frown at the water, I see a frowning face. So too, a human being mirrors back what you show that human being. You show that human being love and respect and care and concern, they will feel that to you. It would seem that if we religious Jews would be more appreciative of all of the sacrifices of those who have contributed in their way to the building and preservation and protection of Eretz Israel, then I think those would also see the value of Torah learning and religiosity and Shemiras HaMitzvos. And in that way, instead of each side looking at the other as evil, as bad, as stupid, each side could see the strength and the goodness of the other, but it starts off by looking at the other in a positive way, and then the other will feel that way about your values as well. So B'ezras Hashem, I hope HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help us, and in this way, may all of us be participants in bringing this Geula Shleima B'mehera V'yameinu.
Remember, you're saying...